This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're doing our season one wrap-up. We have a lot of feedback to cover. We want to talk a little bit about where the future and perhaps the past of the Game of Thrones franchise is headed. And a couple other things. Give our hopes, our dreams, our fears, our thoughts on what's going to happen with House of the Dragon next season. I'm excited. What about you?
I'm very excited. And this also, it turns out, it's not going to be our last wrap-up podcast. I'm going to be joining Kim Renfrow to, we couldn't, she's a busy, busy lady. We couldn't get her roped down in time to do this podcast. So I expanded her outline a bit, fleshed out the conversation a little bit more, and we'll be talking the Wednesday after you hear this podcast, and it'll be out the following week. So we'll have one more wrap-up. It'll be me and Kim Renfrow of Insider and Cast of Kings fame, and we're going to be talking about our experiences co-hosting a show with one with dumb co-hosts that don't read the books. And we're going to be talking about the impact of the prophecies on Hot D this season. And, one thing that to transition into the outline proper, one thing I want to ask him is, like, what do we think the odds are that the community will largely remain unspoiled? I thought throughout Game of Thrones, for the most part, the community did very well. When I talk about the book readers, keeping things out of the community from being spoiled. And I felt like late in the run when there were some episode leaks, maybe that, but I don't think that was book readers to blame. And I just want to give a warning that a lot of people are going back and, you know, missing Game of Thrones. Like, you probably haven't had the desire to go back and rewatch that, but, you know, clips are popping up on TikTok and on Twitter and Instagram, and you're like, God damn, I really liked those first few seasons. Let me dip my toes back in. You need to know that there are significant House of the Dragon spoilers as early as season 3, episode 4.
Okay.
Like, when you get to a scene where Joffrey is detailing a whole bunch of Targaryen history as he's showing off a bunch of stuff in the Great Sept of Baelor, as he's planning his wedding to Margaery, and she's pretending to be completely enthralled, there's going to be huge House of the Dragon spoilers for fates of several characters. Now, I will say that I think, from my lights, Joffrey got some of his history wrong. But still, enough right that there's probably going to be a lot of disappointed people. So and that's what I'm getting at. Like, since this is a complete done deal, and it only takes about 200 pages of reading to get, like, I do worry that as the seasons go on, that it's going to be harder and harder to remain unsullied, you know, with all the stuff we do online. Having said that, like, as a person who's got the whole thing spoiled, I had a ball covering this season. So I don't know that it's necessarily a detriment, but it has changed my guidance on whether people should read this book or not. I was telling people, unless you're just, like, burning to do it, I wouldn't. But now that I'm, you know, and I don't know, maybe my conversation with Kim will change my mind. I'm like, yeah, if you think that you might be interested in it, might as well. Might as well, because then you can play the who's right, Mushroom or Orwell kind of game along with everybody else.
Sure.
What you got any thoughts on that, Jim?
I don't think it's changed my mind. I don't plan on,
because you're off. You do stay off of all social media. It's considerably easier for you to stay unspoiled than your average person.
Yeah, I run across very few spoilers. I try and stay out of the channels of the spoiler channels over in our Discord, especially during the off season and leading into the new season. So I don't see a lot of spoilers, luckily for me. But I imagine for most people that's not true. So I don't know, man. I don't know how you thread the needle of that life, which is one of the various reasons that I'm don't really participate in social media much.
Yeah. So I did say that I would help people out and give some book some page numbers. Now I'm talking about, this is the first edition Fire and Blood release, hardbound book. So if you have any other release, I don't know that I can give you it to precise guidance. But if you start on, it starts on a basically page 344, which let me actually go. Okay, so you could start off, there's a sub chapters that's all divided, and this is Heirs of the Dragon, A Question of Succession. That starts just a couple of pages earlier than the one I just gave out. But yeah, if you start on there, and we are approximately page 391. So we've gone about just under 40 pages, and we're at the Dying of the Dragons, the Blacks and the Greens, essentially. So you're going to be reading page again, if you're reading in a hard book, about page 344 to 590, which is about 246 pages worth of reading. But not there's bad. Honestly, if you're in for a pinch, in for a pound, go ahead and read all the Targaryen history up to there. It's only 200 pages.
Sure.
You know, and there's a lot of fascinating stuff into there, as well. So yeah, if you do want to follow along, hopefully I'll give you a little bit of a guide. You can find that those chapter headings, whether you're using a Kindle or anything. I thought, Jim, before we move on, we could talk about maybe some hopes and fears and just some stuff that I had, as a person who's covering the show, as a fan of the books, as a fan of the show.
Sure.
The first thing I want to talk about is something I've gotten some feedback on, which is, you know, people are like, oh, Aaron, we really missed a spoiler stuff where you're talking about in-depth theories and what's coming next. And, you know, this year I made a conscious decision to not do any of that because honestly, I didn't think there'd be much of it. It's like, well, I could just tell people what's going to probably happen next week or in the weeks to come. But that's kind of dumb. I didn't think there'd be like real prophecies or, you know, but turns out I'm wrong. There's this whole magic knife. There is a whole, you know, Aegon being a dreamer and getting these prophecies. There's a lot more to kind of unpack. Helena was spitting prophecies and whatnot. I'm wondering how I might go ahead. And I'm wondering if I could talk with Maester Anthony and see if he wants to do something a little bit more formalized with the Maester's Corner. Or maybe try to transform that to something that's a little bit more, you know, deeper secrets of Westeros type of thing. I do, because it's not like there was enough material for every week to have like a big old giant conversation. But
yeah.
I think we could have done there's a couple things we could have done a little bit more with. You know, if Maester Anthony can't do it because of whatever reason, I might pull a David Chin and just find some high profile YouTuber.
Yeah, Alt-Shift-X. Why not? Why not just get all chipped?
Go up there
podcast,
and be like,
right?
"You're the most popular YouTuber. We're the most popular independent podcasters. Can we do anything with that?" And he'll probably say no. And then I'll get the second right? most notable YouTube. Yeah, so it'll something like that. But I've heard the feedback, and I'm gonna try. I'm gonna try to come up with something before next season.
Cool.
I feel free to break in with any that you want to talk about. But
yeah,
the
I've got
other
a few.
One. Okay. Well, why don't you go?
Here's my worry, and I've got hopes and dreams and then things I want to see, but I'm going to talk about my worry first. We ran like we danced on a tenuous line between what was on the screen and what the creators kind of intended and were talking about in the Inside the Episode segments. I'm really worried that they had some ideas about what was supposed to be to make it to the screen that kind of didn't, and it actually worked out for the best. And I'm worried that if they completely lined up their ideologies with what they showed us, that it might have been a worse season. I'm really scared that they're actually going to like fix that next season, if you know what I mean. Like, I just because I found myself disagreeing with them in a lot of ways, but agreeing with what they actually put on screen in enjoying what they put on screen more than the stuff that they said might have been kind of intended.
Yeah, so that's something that I've seen discussed a lot. Maybe I can try to assuage or assuage your fears.
Sure, I love sausage.
So a lot of people point out that these are mostly done, like, there's a day, you know, that's like, oh, we're going to sit down with Emma Darcy and we're going to talk to them about their experience, and they're going to be wearing their gown or costume, and we're going to sit down for an hour and we're going to talk, and then we're going to use snippets of that throughout the whole. It's not like at the end of every episode wrap, they get everyone together. So there's a lot of like kind of hazy, gauzy, maybe things haven't even been filmed that they're talking about. It's just on a punch list that they don't really know. The other thing is there might be some intentional stealth. You know, like there's a blade of armor that they're trying to mislead people to, you know, come to false conclusions to preserve their own surprises for it. Because like some of the stuff they said was just stupid, I thought.
Right, right.
And I wonder how much of, because like,
and blatantly wrong when you see the next episode, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Contradicted by things that happen on screen. It's like, you know, has Ryan Condal seen his own show? Surely. Right. So like, I wonder if that's a real thing. Like if they actually thought, oh God, people misunderstood stuff. We're supposed to understand that Rhaenys just is a mommy and she saw another mommy and she just can't kill her. Like
We're supposed to understand that Daemon just can't get it up. He just can't get it up.
He has a long-standing erection problem that we've been very clear about throughout. So, like, I don't know if it's like they're seeing the fan reactions like, oh, shit, we got to go make sure that they, or it's misunderstandings, or it's a little bit of stagecraft. If they are 100% honest about what we were supposed to get out of those after the episode interviews, I'm a little nervous too, I gotta say.
I mean, I've already fixed it by just not watching those things anymore. That's my plan.
But they fix it back by like,
exactly.
Well, we just need to,
I don't want them to fix it. I want them to leave it how it was, because I thought that's my other hope for this thing is that they keep the quality of writing where it is, because I've been extremely impressed by it. So I don't want them to go fix this perceived problem and then have it turn out in a worse script, a worse show.
There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
And now, back to Hot D. Yeah, I agree. One thing that I have a hope for is the rest of the audience to come back. You know, it seems like everyone was thrilled. I saw that Ryan Condal in several interviews mentioned that he was honestly surprised and delighted at how quickly the audience seemed to just re-engage with this material, because he thought, you know, after, you know, people had feelings about how the old show developed, and also he was couching as like, oh, I'm following this master act and I'm, you know, like I, whatever.
Partially, sure.
But, you know, you look at stats and it's hard to do apples to apples. And I was looking at Wikipedia, who was going, you know, all what seemed to always compare essentially Sunday night returns to Sunday night returns. And it goes back to Game of Thrones. So like Game of Thrones started with 2.2 million people watching it and ended with 13.6 million. According to Hot D's statistics, you had 2.17 people watching it to begin with, and it ended with 1.85 million. Now, HBO's internal statistics that they released suggested that 10 million people watched that first episode. And I think these are plus three from all sources type of stuff, you know, from streaming and everything. And that essentially the exact same amount of people watch the finale, which is rare. You usually start off and then you kind of lose audiences through the season, and maybe you gain some, maybe you lose some in the off season, but through the season, you almost always lose. Mm-hmm. Kind of remarkable that everyone that sat down to watch Hot D essentially finished watching Hot D. But where is that? Because, like, you know, HBO is also releasing numbers that suggested 50 million people were watching season 7, and up to 100 million people saw within the first several days the finale of Game of Thrones. Where the hell are those people at? Are they do you think that there will be a new do you think that we'll have twice the audience next year because people will hear that, like, actually Hot D is good? And I imagine on a binge, this is a real fucking barn burner.
Oh, yeah.
If you're a Game of Thrones fan. And maybe some of the time jumps won't be as heinous. Although maybe watching it by yourself is a little bit lonelier because you're not going to have podcasts and everybody else explaining, like, the different time jumps and what's happening, and there'll be bigger What do you think that this is all we're going to get? Or do you think this is going to grow to be a juggernaut kind of like Game of Thrones?
No, I expect it to get bigger. Like you said, I think there are a lot of people who sat out this season of Game of Thrones, or sorry, House of the Dragon, because of the way the Game of Thrones ended. And I think if they hear that it's actually excellent, they'll be back. And I think that was the general opinion. Certainly from critics it was. I think the audience had a little less tolerance for it, but you know, honestly, that was probably just fear. That was people's worries that it would just run off the tracks somewhere through the season, but it didn't. It stayed excellent throughout. So yeah, I expect people to return next season.
Do you have yet another point you'd like to talk about?
One of my hopes for next season, and I know this is supposed to be kind of a shorter series, right? This won't be the 8th season journey that we got with Game of Thrones. So
certainly
I could see this happening next season. They've set up a few rivalries, and I really, really enjoyed some of the rivalries they're setting up. I kind of want to see one of those pop off next season. I don't know if it'll be Daemon and Aemon, because that seems like the big one that could be stirring.
The Dragon Ball D.
Yeah. But maybe like a Kristen and Daemon. I could see something like, or Kristen and Sir Wellington. What's his name? the Kingsguard that quit.
Oh, Eric.
No, the one that quit. The Lord Commander of the Kingsguard.
Oh, Westerling.
Westerling,
Sir Harold Westerling.
Not Wellington. Maybe him and Kristen go at it.
I love
could see
beef.
That. He's got big beef with Kristen, yeah.
He's got big beef. It's breaded. It's pastrified. Mm-hmm. That's all kind of beef he's got.
So I would love to see one of those play out. Since we're looking at maybe a 3-season run, I could see that happening in season 2.
So I want to dovetail that with a fear of mine as a person who's read the story. I wonder how the community will handle a real Civil War story where huge characters are going to necessarily have to die and be replaced, and then their replacements die too. You know, like, there's this plot in HBO's Band of Brothers. I think it's actually called, the episode's called The Replacements, where you had the original guys who kind of like trained together and shipped that together, has been through all this, and they're halfway through the war and half of them had died now. And when the replacements show, they don't even bother to learn their name. Mm-hmm. Because, like, fuck you. You don't have any idea. You're probably going to be dead in a week anyway. So, like, you know, wait. If you can survive a month or two, then maybe we'll bother to learn your names. And I wonder if the community will be that way, too. If they'll get jaded. Because I think even more so than, like, mid-season Game of Thrones, which is what Condal is promising in some of these interviews, like, the death toll is going to be just like every 3 weeks someone major is going to die, and it's not going to be someone, you know, like, these are going to be, you know, people riding dragons are going to be at the forefront of the combat, and they're going to have, if the show's going to remain true to the book and realistic, people are going to have to die. And I wonder, as people's faves, as people's problematic faves, as the big villains die and have to be replaced, if, like, people will hang with the show, or if, like, you're just going to, like, real war fatigue, like, you're just going to have a broken heart and just like, yo, this show makes me feel miserable.
Yeah, I didn't consider that when I said, are a bunch of people going to come back? And they might come back, but then they might leave again when their problematic fave dies.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if Arya Stark dies, we riot. Well, right, what if there's a moment like that three times a year where it's like, well, if XY dies, if this guy, a person dies, if this lady dies, if it's like, well, what happens if all that? And there's still a season and a half a show because of the way. Yeah, I do have a slight worry that people are. Yeah, because like the thing, Game of Thrones is like, oh, yeah, it kills all your favorite characters. And it does. Mm-hmm. But it also really slows its roll, you know, for the vast part of the mid stretch, you know.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got Oberyn, and then it's a while.
And then Oberyn he's introduced in the season that killed him off. It's not like he was Sansa Stark or Jon Snow or anybody like that. So, like, I do wonder if people are going to be really prepared for the pace at which this war goes on. Or maybe the show has a way of slowing things down and making this a bit more of a slog, which also has its risks.
Sure. No, that's interesting. I think as long as it's these deaths are earned and feel like they were well considered, I don't think people will be too upset, or at least so upset that they leave the show. I think as long as they kill their characters in cool and seemingly necessary ways, because I just like some of the deaths, you know, are a death can be pointless and a death can be poorly written and poorly considered, and that is what will upset me. But it doesn't seem like they're headed that direction.
It doesn't, because, like, you know, Oberyn, that's a good example, because his death is kind of pointless and you know, dispiriting, but it's extremely well written.
Oh yeah.
Like it's the exact kind of like kick in the nuts you kind of, I think, want from Game of Thrones. You know, the kind of thing that like other shows are just not going to do to you. They're not going to hurt you that much.
Right.
All right. You have another hope / fear /
not off the top of my head. No.
All right. I've got a couple more.
Okay.
A related point. The greens and blacks thing really popped off this season. And before we even got to the real dirty fighting, and I heard stories like, we, you know, our community, I think, you know, kudos to all of our Discord moderators, to all of our moderators and all our communities. I think they do a really good job. But I heard that like some things on like r/ a house of the dragon, things got pugilistic, things got flame war, people got banned. I do wonder if, you know, they do keep true to the pacing, to the death count, if it's just going to be untenable. Like, you know, that you don't have a united fan base of 10 million people. You have 7 million-ish blacks versus 3 million-ish greens, and they just stalk each other across social media, spewing hatred and bile. Like, can't affect. But on the other hand, like, that's essentially all sporting type fandom rivalries, and that shit is super popular. So, like, maybe it will make it even more popular.
I've got a suggestion. Let's get ahead of this. Let's go to our Discord and let's create a channel called the Dragon Pit. And that is where you are allowed to sling your most vile insults, your most personal attacks. No holds barred in the Dragon Pit.
I feel like we've experimented with this in bald movie communities, and it just always leaks out. You're like, oh, you know, well, let's have a no holds barred, rules free, you know, the Purge. Let's just let's have a channel that's called the Purge, and people just, and it just, no, the Purge infects every other channel. But
yeah, you just make mods hard job harder. That's no good.
Yeah. Well, and then it's like, so like that's another, like, you know, in terms of pacing, that's another kind of hope / fear. That I'm hopeful that as this story is going to necessarily expand to involve the rest of the realm, like, we were really laser like focused on the Blackwater Bay, essentially King's Landing, Dragonstone, Driftmark. Now that there's a civil war and Banner's going to be called, there's going to involve the rest of the realm. And I love how this entire first series was essentially centralized on these women characters. And getting to know them and their motivation. I think it's going to make everything work, but it did come at the expense of even meeting important characters, important parties like the Starks, the Aarons. And I wonder, you know, like what's the community going to think if we have a whole first episode in season two that's like the realm reacts and we just go around and visit the Hightowers getting their ravens in Old Town, and then maybe we meet the youngest of Alicent and Viserys' kids, Darren, finally, because he's supposed to be in Old Town. You go to the Vale, you check on Jane and Arryn and the Eyrie. You know, Daemon was going to see her about contesting his claim to his runestone versus his first wife he murdered. That was mentioned, but we never see it happen on camera. Like, what does she think of all this? Check in on the Riverlands. Maybe we just follow Jace. This first episode is going to be Jace just going along completely blissfully unaware of his brother's travails with the Baratheons and Aemon, but they got to do something to establish all these fine balances of power and loyalties and treacheries, because otherwise, if like, you know, a great house just joins a battle at the last minute, it's going to seem like, you know, the writers are just selecting, you know, Deus Ex Machina. Oh, this, you know, the Aerons rode in with this huge host, like, where the fuck, why would they? Could all make sense, but like, you got to establish, you got to stay one step, but you got to establish and display things you will need so you can tell their stories. And they haven't done any of that yet.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's the reverse Chekhov stuff, right? Like, if you show the gun in act one, it's got to go off in act three. Well, if something's going to happen in act three, you got to set it up in act one. So,
right. Or it's going to seem unearned. So I think that they can do it. And I think, you know, spending some time in this first few episodes, you had this big bang moment. You know, it's kind of like, exploring Jacerys and his quest to get his mother's bannermen and together. And then maybe an episode or two of that to prime it. And also, you know, that's the other thing, is I keep hoping that they do not cling to their credit sequence and they go more to like a painted table type of map situation, because I think people are going to need it. And it seems like people are thirsty for it.
Yeah, I think it was universally the opinion that the intro was not very good for this show.
Yeah.
So hopefully they take that to heart.
So I think I also have some random observations I saw from different Ryan. I read like five different Ryan Condal interviews the last few days. Here's one from the New York Times. Condal essentially mea culpa'd for the lighting on some of the episodes, particularly episode 7 everyone talks about. Yeah. And he didn't throw anyone under the bus. And he's like, you know, you never know how things are going to be compressed and different people's televisions and stuff. But he's like, bottom line is obviously this missed a mark and we're going to look at it as we go forward in season. So hopefully, but it's like, hopefully they'll get it fixed. But again, this was a big complaint with the same director in the old series too.
Just don't shoot day for night. Come on, people.
Or you can do it. There's ways to do it, but you can't half-ass it. Yeah. He had a Times interview in the London Times where he said that he recognized that there wasn't enough humor potentially in this season because, you know, we don't have Tyrion and we don't have Peter Dinklage playing him. And that was such, you know, that was such a nexus of the humor. But they're looking for to introduce a quote, natural pathways into moments of levity in the drama. And he says, I don't have Peter Dinklage, but I do have Matt Smith. He says, I think Matt Smith is very funny. If there's one character that does not care, it's Daemon. And that was a lot of the humor. Like, I just like seeing Daemon react to shit.
But he's so angry right now. He's so angry.
He is very angry right now.
He doesn't seem like a very funny man in this moment, but maybe that will change.
I mean, that's the thing. Is like, this guy was managed to be hilarious, beating to death a messenger. Like, I still think one of the top five Daemon moments is the way he kind of like, with a flourish, grabbed that message and opened it, and just was like he's Ralph Fiennes in Grand Budapest Hotel, and he goes from that to just savagely beating this dude to death at the helmet. I don't know. I think that's funny. So in Entertainment Weekly, they interviewed Gurm and Ryan Condal separately. And Gurm was very adamant about this story needs four seasons of 10 full episodes to get the story told in the way that he thinks it needs to be told. And I thought it was interesting that Condal immediately was careful to not commit to that and says, well, you know, I need to break season two to see kind of what I think the final shape of the season is. And I honestly, my eyebrow raised a little bit at four seasons. I thought three seasons when I was looking at this and kind of breaking down the moments and stuff. I was thinking three. I wouldn't be horrified for four, especially since they spent 10 episodes going over 40-ish odd pages out of the, you know, 240, 250 they're going to need to get through. But like, if they continue to do that, but I don't know, because like there aren't any, you know, that's the other thing, is there's no more time jumps. They established that in this Entertainment Weekly episode, that going forward, that things are going to mainly happen in real time. That seems, I don't know. I am a little worried that Gurm and Condal are not 100% seeing eye to eye on how long this thing should be.
Yeah, it's especially interesting given that, you know, Condal's the showrunner and he's out of a job when the show ends. Martin is not, right? He's got 400 other spinoffs and novels he can write. You would think that Condal would want to be preserving this for as long as reasonably possible. Maybe he just doesn't want to commit what he knows is like 8 years of his life to this thing, because four seasons doesn't mean 4 years anymore, right? When we're talking about, okay, it's not going to release sure. for a year and a half after yeah. the last one came out. You're talking about eight, yeah. potentially 10 years of your life on four seasons of television. Yeah. So maybe he just doesn't want to commit to that chunk of his life, but I would think he would have a lot of reasons to want to continue the show as long as possible, because he's yeah, going to be one of the biggest showrunners on the planet while it's on.
He also, in one of these interviews, I can't remember which one because I didn't write this down, but he, you know, he floated the idea of an anthology where you could uh-huh. go back and go look at the original Conquest with Aegon the Conqueror. You could go forward to the Blackfyre Rebellion.
Yeah, so maybe he's just eager to get to those stories, and, right? And like, he doesn't want to draw like, this out.
And that's like one commitment at a time. It's like, okay, do I want to do 2-3 more years of this? Okay, well then I'll do the first Blackfyre Rebellion, or I'll do and like I can get at it any time, but like also I can extend this almost indefinitely as long as there's an appetite mm-hmm. and as long as people are not. I mean, HBO is going to have a real problem in their hands when people get tired of scheming for thrones, incest, and dragons, because
because all their shows are that. Yeah.
Well, I'm just like, if guess what the Blackfyre Rebellion's about? Mm-hmm. It's about certain Targaryens thinking they should be the ones on the throne and these other Targaryens are not. Guess what?
Succession is about. Guess what? Yeah, industry sure. or whatever it's called is about. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, a lot of this stuff is, as you mentioned, it's classic soap opera stuff. It's classic Mad Men stuff. It's human drama. But like this particular flavor, will people not get tired of mm-hmm. people with dragons thinking they should be the ones that rule and then conquering and bending to their will with fire and blood the people that don't? You know, like if that ever gets dull, then they might have a problem yeah. there. But not, if not, there's like just endless fascinations and details and varieties of these events. So,
and if it does get dull, I could do with a few more spaceships in my soap operas. So, yeah, true. Give me some sci-fi stuff.
What do you think about, I want to revisit, we found out mid-season that Sapochnik is no longer going to be a part of the season, of season two going forward, that mm-hmm. he is bowing out as fellow showrunner, and they brought on Alan Taylor, who is not going to be a showrunner. He is joining as a writer, executive producer, but it's going to be Condal calling the shots going forward. How, on scale 1 to 10, how nervous does that make you?
Not very. I always saw Sapochnik as more the directorial side of the production, right. even though now he's a co-showrunner.
And 1/3 of the episodes he directed could not be seen by the average person with the average sure. TV setup. So,
yeah, but I feel like whatever needed to be transferred from the Game of Thrones, you know, Bible has been transferred at this yeah. point. And Condal yeah. is up to speed on that stuff, and whatever Sapochnik could have brought to him, he's contributed already. And yeah. I'm sure he would have more to contribute in the future if he chose to stay, but he hasn't. And so it doesn't make me super nervous. Now, if season two falters, I will start to look at this and say, oh, is this because
this might be
Sapochnik left? Yeah. Is this an effect of it? And I'll be worried about season three. Yeah. But so far, so good. I'm not super worried about anything here, honestly. I think they've done a great job so far, and I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt next season.
Yeah, I'm not too. I'm like a 2 out of 10, maybe a 1 out of 5 worried, because there is that possibility. But like, you know, when I was reading these, I felt a growing confidence, unlike when I was looking at the guys over on the T-Rop side of things, where it's like I read them and like they literally don't know what the fuck they're doing, and they have they literally cannot cite relevant industry experience. Where Condal is talking about like, well, you know, I had this one pilot series that I shot and produced for NBC, and it's this weird sci-fi western, and I learned this and that from that experience, and then of course I had Colony. And, you know, that actually got the series. We had several seasons and, you know, but I also had some frustrations here and that. It's like this guy was actually saying, like, this is how I leveled up as a showrunner. And I had this budget, and then I had this budget, and I had this material, and then I had this material. And now I've got this. Like, it feels like a clear progression in a way that inspired confidence of like, OK, this guy has actually worked his way up to something this high profile, where I was like, Ryan Condal, who? Before, because I'd never seen Colony, and I'd certainly never seen this weird sci-fi western thing that he was talking about, which sounded really fucking cool.
I saw some of Colony.
Did you?
And I thought it was pretty good. I didn't stick with it. I know it was co-created by Carlton Cuse, who was one of the
Lost dudes.
Co-writers and producers, and I think showrunners on Lost, along with Lindelof. So yeah, I've liked his work in the past. I think he's worked with people who get it, who know how to run a show. Say what you will about the ending of Lost, right? I don't think that's a problem here, because they have a direction. It's in the books.
Yes,
it's already written. So yeah, I'm very happy with what they did this season, and I have a lot of faith in them to knock it out of the park, even without Sapochnik next year.
Yeah. And I do like I do think Sapochnik brings a little bit something extra to the action. Like, I think the pilot of this season works a lot because of Sapochnik has that gift of filming, and he was able to, you know, make that bring that analogy to the birthing bed sequences too, and they're equally kind of given drama and weight. And I kind of, but like, also before season six of Game of Thrones, like, who the hell was Miguel Sapochnik? Like, before the Battle of the Bastards, like, he kind of, between Hard Home and that, kind of launched, like, oh, this is the guy you want on Game. So who is the next Miguel Sapochnik that we're making, you know, that we had a lot of talented directors that we saw this season, and it doesn't seem like a real weakness on the show. So, yeah, I'm very minimally worried about him leaving, and I think it's going to be fine. And I think that's about it for kind of my hopes and fears. Honestly, I'm over the moon. I was so anxious about how this would be seen and received, and I felt a little bit better after I'd seen the pilot episode. And then a month later, I was gratified to see more or less everyone kind of agreed with my take, which is like, yeah, this is a really strong, confident first step. And now that I've seen the whole season, like, and I'm not saying there's zero missteps, but even the ones that I disagreed with, once I saw the whole series, like, you know, we talked about Rhaenys busting out of the dragon pit, like, that made sense. Like, there's very few things when I look back, it's like, you know what, that just felt wrong.
Yeah.
And I, you know, there's one, like I said, I'm still not sure about the prophecy and whether it added more or took more away. But that's what I got a conversation with Kim coming up next week. So
yeah,
I think that'll do it for my thoughts. Do you want to get to what the people had to say and talk about? Oh, actually, do you want to round up the? That's one thing we almost forgot to do. Do you want to round up the spinoffs that they're working on?
Yeah, we have a lot of stuff in the works. The thing that strikes me after looking into all these spinoffs, is just how slow this process is. And we talked about this on the most recent Walking Dead podcast, I think, where they are doing 10 different spinoffs for the Walking Dead show.
It's all go, go, go.
And it is just like green light. You got a pitch. Let's make it. Let's give it a 6-episode run with a green light to light season 2 up. If we even sniff success there. Yeah. This is a much different operation. They are taking their sweet time. They are making sure that the quality of the content they are creating is high, and they're willing to cut things if they're not. And that's a real hallmark of a company that cares about, well, A, their bottom line, it's going to, in the long term, produce much better results for their wallets. But B, cares about what their fans think about the property, not just spitting stuff out there to cash in while there's cash to be had. And so I looked into it, and there is at least 6 spinoffs right now that are in various stages of pre-production, and or you know, production. Obviously, House of the Dragon was one of those that just recently came out. We don't know exactly when we'll get season two, but we expect it not to be till 2024. So that leaves a big gap in there, about a year and a half or so, that we could say, well, are they going to fit something else in, right? And I think the thing that's closest to fruition here is this Snow project, which is a Jon Snow spinoff. It is a sequel to Game of Thrones, so it'd be happening after the events of that series. It was pitched by Kit Harington a while ago, and they've been in pre-production on some stuff, but they've written several different versions of scripts and they've been polishing them up. I think there's a third draft out there that Martin was talking about having gotten, but they've just ordered a pilot, right? They haven't like said, okay, this is definitely going to series or anything. So it's not very likely actually that Snow's going to be coming out before House of the Dragon season two.
That's the thing. When you said it's the furthest along in development, that's like, because people are talking like, oh, we might actually get two Game of Thrones shows in 2024. Because like, that's the other thing is, if you're looking for this to come back in 2023, no one, Condal, Gurm, everyone's saying there's no fucking way. We'd love to, but there's just no way.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell, yeah, this Jon Snow is like, the thing it's got going for it is Kit Harington really, really wants to do it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't think, do they have a showrunner attached to this?
They've got a lot to by now, but there's not a lot of information out there about any of these series. There's essentially like George Martin has said, yes, that's in the works, and he can't say any more about it.
Yeah. And there's a lot like there's a lot that I think you could say about this series. Like, they could soft reboot the ending of Game of Thrones by essentially like, you thought you had the White Walkers contained, but that was just the Vanguard, or that was just this one faction. And now there's, it could be that, like, you know, that's one of the reasons this prophecy is such a big deal, is they're going to this is going to be woven throughout the entire spin. Like, the one thing that holds everything together is this fucking Valyrian steel knife and this prophecy about the stuff that's going to happen north of the wall. So like, I'm kind of excited to see if they can do something like that with, of course, Martin's blessing, you know,
at least in like the mainline Valyrian, you know, and then over in Westeros kind of stuff, they could do that. But there are a lot of spinoffs that won't really be possible for, like, another spinoff is the Sea Snake, which is going to be a show about Corlys's, I guess, nine great voyages is a thing.
The nine voyages, yeah, is what they're calling this.
Yeah. So it was originally titled Nine Voyages. I think they've officially changed the working title to the Sea Snake.
Oh, really? Okay.
Which I'm glad, because the Nine Voyages was a little too Sinbad-y for my taste.
Right.
I don't know. Not a fan. But this probably won't have anything to do with the Targaryen prophecies and the Blade, right?
I don't, because so, first of all, who the fuck knows? Because all we know about this is this guy sailed the furthest to anyone in Westeros has ever been. He goes all the Yi Ti or Yi Ti, which is the analog of China.
Yeah.
He goes further west than anybody's ever been. You know, what's west of Westeros? Corlys might be one of the few men that know. But like, it's just like, this is just why he's such an awesome character. They don't actually go into detail about all the things. It's like, he got fabulously powerful and wealthy and he's the best. So like, they have a blank slate. This could be a fun kind of X-Files mystery monster adventure of the week or season, like, you know, just pirate king for hire kind of. But
yeah,
if he is going over to explore the doom of old Valyria and he is investigating the mysteries of the East,
he could find blades. He could. Sure,
because that's the thing, is like, according to Martin, like, this is kind of like a monomyth along the lines of like a global flood in human history, that like, there is enough cultures that talk about this thing that, you know, maybe there is something that catastrophic to happen in mankind's ancient history. And the Long Night is the same thing. So whether you go to YT or whether you go to, you know, Essos and explore the remnants of old Valyria, like, all the peoples of Middle Earth kind of had this experience. And so they could definitely, well, this is my long-winded way of saying definitely they could get into the prophecies if they wanted to.
Okay. And obviously that one would be set you know, sometime in Corliss's lifetime. So anywhere between like zero yeah. and 40 years before the events of House of the Dragon.
I think you go with young, like, you know, you could get like a hot young guy to be Corliss. You could get a hot young gal to be, you know, because Rhaenys is in the world and she is a dynamic figure, you know.
Sure.
She's a dragon rider. Like, you could involve, you could talk about how they met and their romance. Like, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of hooks. I'm pretty excited for them to see what they come up with this.
Yeah, that, however, is less far along than even the Snow show, which means it's probably not coming out for several years.
They do have Brian Heller attached, who is the co-creator of HBO's Rome, which I've seen nice. Most of the first season, and I had to stop watching it because the fucking call of Bald Move always brings me back to the present. But yeah. like,
I that did was the a same show. With that show.
Right, and it's you can see the DNA of Game of Thrones. Like, it would translate 100%. Effortlessly. So, like, that is a great, great person to have at the helm of the show.
Mm-hmm. I think so. There's another one called 10,000 Ships, which is the story of the immigration of the Rhoynar to Dorne. And this is, you know, at the hands of Queen Nymeria, right, leading them out, because I think the Valyrians were invading. Is that right? The Rhoynar lands, and so they had to
flee. Rhoynar refusing to essentially bending the knee to the Valyrian Empire, and the Valyrians like decided to just wipe them off the map.
Yeah, and so they go over and settle in Dorne, and this is the story of that. Developed by
that
Amanda Siegel.
That Rhaenyra tore out of the history book and gave to Alicent. That was about Queen or Princess Nymeria, and she's this. Very legendary figure. Arya named her direwolf after. She's the patron saint for all little girls in Westeros that want to be a badass warrior queen. She's the template, the blueprint, and the model.
Nice. Yeah. So, I mean, there is, I guess there's perhaps a screenplay floating around somewhere. But again, not very far along in the
who'd you say was attached
process.
To this?
Amanda Siegel, who's done. Things like Person of Interest, she wrote some episodes for that, and
Jonathan
was a
Nolan,
producer, co-executive
right?
producer.
What was it? Yep. Wasn't that a John? Yeah, okay. So,
she's done that. She's done some other television, a lot of television production. So she probably knows her stuff. Nothing I've seen though. I haven't seen any of the shows that she's worked on, but they are fairly popular shows. Like yeah. I said, Person of Interest, The Good Wife.
Yeah. We constantly get. Oh, right. That's those are two shows we constantly got recommendations to watch, mm-hmm. especially in the Person of Interest connection with Westworld, which doesn't look like we're going to get any more Westworld. We'll have to wait for the critic screenings in the winter to confirm. But like, it's not great that they haven't renewed that show yet.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see how that goes. But
little Westworld in your Game of Thrones coverage here.
Yeah. And then another spinoff, which I think you're going to be excited about, is the Duncan Egg spinoff. Not Duncan Egg, Dunk and Egg. I always think this is Duncan Egg.
Uh-huh.
When
uh-huh.
I hear the name pronounced.
Sir Duncan Egg.
Yes. But this is essentially set 90 or so years before Game of Thrones, where Sir Duncan the Tall and Aegon the Fifth, colloquially known as Egg, roam the countryside doing chivalrous deeds. I don't have much more information than that. This feels like a deed of the week type of thing.
Yeah, I came across this. They collected the three short stories that Martin had written. I guess he plans for 12 and he's written three. And he was kind of rolling on them, and then he got so much grief for ignoring Winds of Winter that he said that he was going to kind of swear off at Duncan Egg until he gets Winds done, and now we don't get anything. So,
but he's also said he doesn't want the show to surpass him. He wants to finish these short stories before.
And he might, because like you're right, this is just literally, you've got this Hedge Knight, Sir Duncan the Tall, who's this essentially 7 foot tall, simple, not simple minded, but he's certainly not like a great thinker, but he's got a strong moral code and he just kind of tries to do what right. And there's a lot of interesting hints that like this guy might be an ancestor of Brienne of Tarth, you know, because he's just this giant of a man.
Sure.
And you got Egg, who's like, you know, the open secret of the books is that there's this little you know, avatar looking kid, this bald headed kid that follows him around, named Egg. You later find out that he is one of the heirs, Aegon, in hiding.
Classic, you know, Targaryen kinda, move, shave the head. Yep.
Shave the head. You can't have that silver hair giving you away. And they're cute stories. They're interesting. There's one that's kind of got some spooky stuff in it. And yeah, it's very much like, yeah, quest of the week, quest of the season type and anthology unto itself. And the thing that, like, Martin might be able to do this because these seem to be pretty fun. And all of the things, these are all told in the margins of bigger stories that he's kind of already written. You know, he knows why Egg is in hiding. He knows what happens to Egg eventually. You know, the reign of, like, he's got all that stuff. There's this whole tragedy at Summerhall plot line that I think ties into there. There's a lot of interesting hooks through the main series, and I think this would be a lot of fun.
Nice. Yeah, I could see it being fun. And it doesn't have to be, I wouldn't be worried about, you know, Martin saying, well, he wants to make sure he's finished all these, but he's got competing interest with the novels for Song of Ice and Fire. I wouldn't be too worried about that because this could be 8 years from now, right? I mean, this series might not come out. This might be a phase four kind of Marvel thing where you just, you're planning, okay, we got stories we want to tell, but not for a long time. We've got five other spinoffs. Yeah. Maybe this will be the last one and he'll finish all of those by then.
But yeah.
Who knows? There's also an animated drama that I don't even think has a name yet.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure what it's about. It's just an animated series somewhere in the Game of Thrones universe.
And it's almost like the way it's written and all the write-ups is like HBO is like, you know, this is an expensive fucking show. You know what's cheap? Animation. Let's just we can animate some dragons, right? People won't bitch about the direwolf budget if we just animate everything, right? But like, here's my dirty little secret. I'm not as interested in adult animation. And I don't know why I should be.
I've
liked some dark anime series. I've liked some adult animation. I do like the kind of family anime, but I don't know why I don't take it as seriously as I do live action. But at least I'm open in my bias. You know, I'm not going to like try to snow you. I just like not like I don't watch any of this animated Star Wars stuff. I just don't. I don't never watched I've never watched the animated Star Trek series, even though I've heard that's pretty fantastic. I just. It's a personal fault of mine. I just don't take it as seriously, and it's not fair.
Yeah. But like you said, you admit it. You're upfront about it, and so people can weigh our opinions on this with a grain of salt. I don't have any information on it, and therefore I'm not interested in it. If they can give me some details, maybe I'll be interested in it at some point. But
yeah, I'm not against watching it. I'm just saying that it's not the thing that I'm most excited for by any stretch.
Are you excited for the Golden Empire series?
Oh, I haven't heard of this one.
So this one, it might take place over in, how did you pronounce it? Y-T-E-T?
I always thought it was E-T or E-T, but I think it's actually Y-T.
Y-T, wow, okay. Yeah, so this one there is very little information about, other than it's, you know, the nation is based on Imperial China. It's on the opposite side of the map from Westeros, very mysterious place. That's kind of it. Apparently,
I think this could
Martin
be
says
super
there's
cringy.
A,
unless they get a hell of a lot of East Asian people like in the writing and, you know, pre-production. And yeah, it could get pretty cringy.
Yeah, it's possible. I don't know. The Martin says they've got a great young writer developing the series, but he doesn't say who. But he does think the art and animation is going to be beautiful. Now,
his
I don't
bastard
know
if son, but he's kept in the wings,
sharpened his teeth up, and he's ready. He's ready to bite into that script.
Yeah.
Take a bite of Hollywood with those sharp teeth. I don't know if this is an animated series or what he said. Martin said, I think the art and animation is just going to be beautiful. So it's possible.
Oh,
this
maybe
is an
this
animated
is
thing.
This is one of the animated angles that they're taking.
Yeah, I've seen it written up as two separate things, but it could be one of two animated series that they've been working on.
Oh, you can only tell the Far Eastern empires of Game of Thrones through anime. See mm-hmm. what I mean? Cringy.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of speculation about what went on over in YT. So,
see, in my research in these, I also came across a flea bottom concept. Oh. Did well, you heard, hear this?
I think that one was scrapped. Am I wrong about that?
This is the one that I found. This was like written in late September, so I thought it was the most current from Screen Rant, but it's could also right. just very much like, well, it's known for its poverty and crime, but it's also the, you know, how people like Davos Seaworth and Gendry get their start. But also, like, I just don't know.
Call it Bastard Bottoms.
I don't know what the pores and the crime ridden of King's Landing looks like in kind of, what is this, some kind of David Simon?
Yeah, The Wire of
right.
Game of Thrones, sure.
Right, you know, police overreach and gold cloak brutality. And
just cutting off cocks and...
The endless self-perpetuating cycles of cock cutting and... yeah, I don't know. But we'll the thing is like, I doubt all of these see the light of day.
Yes.
They certainly are not going to see all the light of day at the same time. Or at least I hope not. Because I do think you can fuck around and overexpose this. But yeah. Well, shit, man. We've got almost a full hour without even getting into the people's feedback. Do you want to get into this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Again, hotd at baldmove.com is how you get email into us. I will say that we are probably going to be going away for a long while. But if you want to send stuff in, if you see news on the off season you want us to talk about or something, that a burning question that you'd like to get a resolution to before season two, we'll be coming back every 10 to 12 weeks or so. I don't know if we'll do that the first cycle because we just got done with Hot D, but like we will be coming back from time to time and taking the microphone back from Anthony as he takes a break from his chapter by chapter discourse of A Clash of Kings. So like, yeah, send that stuff in. I will be checking the email before we do an update to see if there's anything worth talking about or there's questions that people have got. So yeah, it's not going to go completely dead in the off season. But let's get all the season one business out of the way. Melanie says, I just want to give Hadi the props they deserve for having the confidence to show the four childbirths and not feel the need to overcompensate with gratuitous sex scenes. People may not like watching the birthing scenes, but they have narratives and thematic value, and they're supposed to be hard to watch. I was originally amused by the sex position and weird sex scenes of Game of Thrones, but it quickly got old for me. It's like they thought people would stop watching if they didn't hit their naked whore slash orgy quota for the season. I found the sex in this show to be relevant to the plot, and young Rhaenyra was allowed to discover her sexuality and grow up without being raped or tortured. That's nice. Nice for a young woman in Westeros. Contrasting with Allison's lame, dutiful sex with Viserys, who is medium old and gross at the time. But had a clear thematic purpose. I'm a big lore whore, so I've read Fire and Blood, The World of Ice and Fire, etc. But Hot D managed to exceed my wildest expectations and have genuinely shocking moments that made me connect with the characters in a way I could never have from the source material. I never imagined I would actually really like Alicent and be able to relate to both her and Rhaenyra. I sincerely hope they continue this pattern as both of our queens are going to be out for blood in season two. I got a couple emails along these lines, and that was one thing I was little medium worried about going out of the pilot is like, boy, there is the return of sex position. Like, do you remember that first episode? How like dudes are in mid thrust, like listening to Daemon give a proclamation or all of Flea Bottom is watching Daemon fail to arrive with Missaria. Like, it's like, oh man, there's like four big sex scenes, where people are talking, but that was kind of a first episode thing.
It was. I don't know. I don't have as much of a problem with that stuff. I think, look.
I don't either. You can overdo it.
You're HBO. You've got the ability to do this stuff. It's one of the few places that is willing to do it. So do it. I don't have a huge problem with it. But you're right. I do also very much appreciate the stuff that is done for a reason. And I think Game of Thrones did that occasionally. It wasn't all just like, oh, Littlefinger works in a brothel and he's going to have these two employees banging in the background while he's giving a speech. That was pretty useless. But then you get stuff like the truly horrible and gratuitous stuff that happened with like Joffrey and Rosalyn, and I'm like, well, that's horrifying, but that's actually for a purpose too. So, you know, Game of Thrones did it occasionally for good meaning, but
yeah,
I don't know. I agree. I'm glad they were doing some things right there.
I think that I'm with you. I'm not offended by it, but like I do think some of the earlier they realize. But I also think that the reason they did that in season one is because they just didn't write enough material and they had to go back and essentially deliver these long monologues and they were worried that people would get bored. So it's like, you know what? Instead of just the monologue, let's have Littlefinger doing it while there's two women having sex with each other. And I think it's something we can say now looking at the Double D's body of work together. They're a little cringe. They're not cringe.
Sometimes.
I think, you know, they were not not above appearing or appealing to people's more base instincts at times. So
there's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. And now, back to Hot D.
Duckin is back, or is here to say, I can't remember which one of you said that Aemon not killing Luke was a little disappointing because it took away some of his badassery, but I disagree. I think the story purposely makes a lot of parallels to Aemon and Daemon. First and most obvious, their names. Yep. You nailed them there. You also got their appearance, the way they wear their hair, the way Aemon tries to portray himself as a bloodthirsty badass. Hell, even riding a cool-ass dragon. But the conflict of Luke shows that all these things in common are also different. Aemon's an impulsive adolescent. He's a neglected second son who feels less important than his brother and sister and has to act out to show he has grit. Whereas Daemon, although he, you know, started off as all those things, is that now a battle-tested warrior, the rogue prince with the dragon that he rides and wins wars with. He's the top cop of the city. He basks in the bloodlust as the city watch disfigured criminals. Not to mention Daemon has clearly a stronger connection with his dragon and that the bargain liquid snake does not have. Aemon is a hollow imitation of Daemon, and I believe in their conflict to come, which has been foreshadowed, is going to be a noticeable difference. Either Daemon not taking his opponent seriously in a fight, or a switch where Aemon will flip, where he becomes Daemon, aka our new problematic fave. Do you think that there's a chance that Daemon's going to underestimate Aemon, or that Aemon will level up after this accidental slaying of his nephew and become the badass that Daemon already is?
I think, yeah, what you saw with him and Kristen in the tournament earlier on was him kind of underestimating somebody, or overestimating himself, maybe. So I could see him doing that again, for sure.
Or letting his emotions get in the way. Yeah. Like, you know, I think he could be baited. It's interesting to see him.
Pretty
do
easy
that.
To bait Aemon as well. I mean, all you gotta do is put a pig in front of him. He loses his damn mind.
Yeah. Carter says, with the seemingly large differences in reception between Hot D and Season 8 of Game of Thrones, what do you think about the series serving as a soft reboot of the franchise? There's plenty of minor differences that could be ascribed to the 200-year time difference, but they also could serve to set up a new world more in line with the books. The extra swords surrounding the throne, more fantastical armor sets, the more distinct-looking dragons, to name just a few. My long shot wish is after they finish the dance series, they do a shorter show about Robert's Rebellion. Hell, you could even get Elrond to play young Ned again. After that, they're mentioning that Elrond for the T-Rop series is the young Ned that we saw in all the Bran-enabled flashbacks to the Tower of Joy sequences, all that.
Yeah.
After that, they can let the cast age up for 5 to 10 years while they make whatever prequels they want to do, then bring back the cast to reprise their roles in a new reboot. Boy, this is the dream of rebooting Game of Thrones.
I don't like it. I've never liked this idea. I don't like the idea of trying to retcon Game of Thrones by refilming a season 7 and 8, or even just
but
a season 8.
But he's talking about doing it, starting it all over.
I know.
And like, man.
Yeah, I don't like any of that. Look, you made your bed, fucking lie in it, and try and do what you can to repair your audience's faith in you going forward. Don't worry about this. Granted, colossal misstep. Just do what you can to make great television going forward.
Even if it's, let's say another decade's gone past and Martin, above all odds, before he dies, long live the king, he gets out both wins and dream.
Sure.
And everyone thinks it's amazing. It's like, oh my God, this is the series we really want out of Game of Thrones. You're telling me you wouldn't get on for like them redoing season 6, 7, and 8 with the completely, they wouldn't have Maisie Williams. They'd have to get a completely new cast. They wouldn't have Kit Harington, perhaps. They'd have to get a whole new cast. But like, I don't know.
I mean, here's the thing. Would I watch it? Yes, of course. Would I feel good about like the state of the Game of Thrones universe having to reboot half of a series with new actors and like, how am I supposed to watch that? How am I supposed to watch that? If I'm new to the Game of Thrones universe, do I come in, I watch seasons 1 through 5 of Game of Thrones, and then I stop watching and I go with an all new cast and try and figure out who's who and watch season 6, 7, and 8 in a reboot form? Or do I watch it all, realize how shitty the ending of Game of Thrones was, and then come back and watch 3 seasons of a reboot with new actors? I just think it's a mess. It's a mess if you try and do that, and it's not gonna fix anything. The stain of Game of Thrones will still be there. Like, if it's essential, I guess, to telling the stories that you want to tell in spinoffs, I guess go ahead and do it. But I don't know why you couldn't just tell those stories. Is the ending? Martin's already said the ending is going to be roughly the same, right? With Bran on the throne and all this stuff. So like,
very roughly. This final shape, yeah.
So you don't absolutely need to go change it. You'd just be admitting there was a huge fucking flaw in the end of Game of Thrones, and B, confusing the issue as to what people should watch going forward with your other shows. I don't think it's worth doing.
I like how Michael Crichton did it in, like, when, because he retconned Ian Malcolm.
Sure.
Dying in the first Jurassic World with, like, oh, there was a lot of confused reports, you know, like dinosaurs invaded, you know, rampaging this island, and there's a lot of early
that's
reports.
It's easier to do when you didn't see it, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I guess. But we've been talking about anime and animation a lot. This has happened, I think, two or three times I can think of in anime. The one that just jumps to my mind is Full Metal Alchemist. Like, that started with the manga having a good head start over the series. It caught up and they just like, fuck, what do we do? They came up with, they kind of made up an ending for the anime. And then they rebooted as once the manga had completed, they rebooted it as the Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood and just did the whole, like, this is actually what really happened. So you can do, I can't think of any times in, like, you know, real life or what do you call that?
Live action
cinema where it's happened. But, like, I wouldn't be mad. Or I always talk about in the Jon Snow sequel, if they just have the world be the way it should be. And then John, like, you know, people talk about, you know, maybe you could start off with having like a bard singing the story of what actually happened. And, you know, Jon Snow is hearing it at a bar or a tavern, you know, in Mole Town or whatever. And he's guy kind of makes a wry observation, like, that's not how I heard it told. Or, and it says, lets people know that, like, we're not going to reboot everything, but you just need to understand that this is how thing, you know, like, Bran is the king and maybe Danny's still alive and there's other people are still, like, but and this is how, I don't know. I'm just saying that, like, I fucking hate season 8 with so much fucking passion that, like, I would be willing to swallow a river of shit to wash that taste out of my mouth. So, like, I'm willing to spend, I agree. Most of the time I would think that's a fucked up franchise that has to do that, but it is what it is. It is what it is.
I say let it be what it is. It's already that. And what do you do with the old series? Do you leave it up for people to watch?
Game of Thrones Legends. So you rebrand it as Game of Thrones Legends.
I mean, if you're going to do the entire series over, sure, I guess. But no one would have the patience for that, right? I don't want a one-to-one with different actors for the first five seasons.
Man, I think that you leave. I think season 1 through 4 are pretty unimpeachable, and pretty much the same for season 5. Pretty much the same for season 6. Wheels definitely start coming off when you get to Dorne in season 5, and some of the other, like the Arya shit. I don't think they did a really good job with her Faceless Man training, and then the wheels really come off in season 7 and 8. But like, I think I would be like, maybe reboot season 7 and 8, maybe redo Arya's storyline. But I don't even think that's necessary.
How do you deliver? I mean, make sure she doesn't fall in the river of shit with her guts splayed open. But
right.
Other than that, yeah. So what do you do with the already existing seasons 7 and 8? Do you leave them up for people to watch?
Yes.
Or do you take them down and replace them with season 7 and 8, and how do you convey that information to a viewer who's like, oh, I'm gonna check out Game of Thrones, and they watch through the first 6 seasons? Now what do you want them to do?
That's a good, I don't know how you do it in HBO Max interface.
That's what I'm getting at. Yeah, like,
but like, I wonder if you could call, like, a Game of Thrones Feast for Crows, and that's the new series that's going to start at the series point of series 7. And, you know, it's kind of a fun play on words. It's Feast of Crows is where, you know, things start to get a little fucko in the narrative on the series. It's also like crows, or, you know, a lot of people were calling themselves crows and ravens and whatnot, you know, Black Brothers, that kind of stuff. After it's like this is a feast for crows. If you are a diehard Game of Thrones fan, this is, and you can ignore it if you, I don't know.
It's a problem.
I feel stupid talking this through, but like, it's something I would be interested in.
Well, I'm trying to just like put myself in a meeting at HBO, or I guess at Discovery now, and say, like, what are we doing with this franchise? Do we want to try and correct the mistakes of the past, or just live with those and move on? And I say move on.
Like, yeah, that's the more attractive option.
I think so. And if
it wasn't for the Jon Snow sequel, I don't think we'd even talk, because none of the other stuff has anything to do. Like, it's all stuff that takes place before. You know, they can definitely embellish things like this prophecy and have new things to think about. But like, yeah, I just think it's stirring up
shit, too. Right. It's like, we've made this mistake. Do we really want to present that mistake in its full just completely bear it to our audience and admit to it? Because HBO has never really admitted this was a terrible season of television.
It was an open secret, another great episode
of Game of Thrones all the way up till the very end. So
yeah, even Condal, when he's like, you know, I was nervous about coming back to Game of Thrones. It was all about living up to the legend. It wasn't like, oh, they shat the bed and I had to steam clean the sheets and I had to refurbish the. It's a good point, but I'm saying, like, in a year, in a world where this Targaryen anthology has gotten a couple of seasons and we've got maybe a Dunkin' Egg thing that spun off and it's been 10 years hence and everyone is like on an all-time Game of Thrones high, and crucially Martin finishes the fucking books, because if
he's got to, you cannot
reshoot this stuff unless I don't support a full series reboot, but like some kind of limited edition series I think would be cool. And the other thing is, like, I think that, like, you can't do a better job, by and large, doing the Harry Potter series than what you did with, you know, Radcliffe and Watson and all those, Murdoch. I don't think you could do a better job, but I'm morally certain in my lifetime someone will do it, because there's money.
Yeah, there's money. They'll reboot that.
So, like, they will probably reboot Harry Potter and do the whole thing with, just like you said, different, even though that's the most pointless thing I can possibly fucking think of.
Right.
So, like, why not Game of Thrones in 10 years? If Martin is leal and gets all this book stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Billy says, I have some feedback for the feedback people. Want to know if they can read A Song of Ice and Fire without being spoiled for House of the Dragon. He says, it's in fact possible to skip the parts you don't want to read. When you see a conversation veering towards Targaryen history or a block of text retelling some historical story, just turn forward a few pages. We have read 99.9% of the books and missed essentially nothing. You can even go to the whole next chapter, which always feels great to make it to a next chapter. The books are amazing and spoiling the show would really suck. Luckily, we can turn pages and circumvent this issue. Please spread the word. Boy, I want to say, yes, that's true, but also, like, you can't control your eyes that way, man. Like, it'd be one thing if it's like Tolkien, where it's like, I said, hey, just skip all the songs. Oh, how do I know if it's a song? Anytime you see a couple pages of italics, just skip it and you'll be fine. Like, if you're reading a Kindle and you're just kind of like next page, next page, next page, and like you're, you know, the next paragraph is a spoiler. I don't know. As a podcaster who reads feedback, I just have a different relationship with spoilers. Like, when I can see something awesome unspoiled, it's always a treat. But, like, it doesn't seem to detract from my enjoyment. And the other thing is, like, a spoiler only can really fuck with your first time watching something.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, when you like stuff, you watch it more than once and you get new things out of it. So, like, I don't know. Like, you, if you're super precious about spoilers, then you really need to stop. You need to not read the books. You need to not revisit the show. And if you are a little bit open minded to, like, well, you know what? Spoilers might not ruin the whole fucking thing. And I'm not going to be butthurt. I'm not going to allow myself to be victimized by spoilers. Then yeah. But, like, I can't in good conscience tell people who are afraid of spoilers, yeah, just read the books. Just tell your eyes to skip over this thing when they start talking about Rhaenyra.
Sure.
You know? But yeah, I'm the type of guy that the doctor always, like, every time they give me a shot, I always look at the needle. Some people don't. I like to look at the needle. Oh, so I don't think I have a very good ability to discipline my eyes. Mara says, thank you for sharing the feedback and portrayal of miscarriage and birth in the House of the Dragon. I myself have suffered both a miscarriage and the death of my daughter at 2 months old.
Oh.
But yet in favor of how birth and childbirth has been shown on the series. I want to share a resource with your listeners who are in similar situations to hopefully help with the loneliness that you've alluded to. Because we talked about, like, you know, what a lonely situation that must be. Mm. I joined a support group called Healing Embrace that meets via Zoom. It's for anyone who has suffered a miscarriage or has had a death of a child under the age of one. It's completely secular and respectful of all beliefs, the old gods and the new, as well as free. I want to pass this along because I'd not heard of this. So this is the collectiveforhope.org. The program that you want to select, because they do grief support in general, but they also have one called Healing Embrace. And if you're in their front page, you'll see that prominently advertised, and there's a link to it in their programs. The collectiveforhope.org, and it's particularly the Healing Embrace. They support pregnancy loss, infant loss, grief support along those lines. So if you are one of those lonely people, whether you're a dad or a mom, however you want to describe yourself, if you experience that type of loss, they can help. And I will vouch, like, I've never gone through this to a support group like this, but I will vouch for how helpful support groups can be when you are dealing with something where you feel like, oh, I'm the only one that's ever felt this way. I'm the only one that can understand this. Like, that's just, when you're talking about a planet of almost 8 billion people, that's never true.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it can take that lonely feeling to a communal feeling, and it just, that automatically helps so much. So once again, Collective for Hope, thecollectiveforhope.org, and check out the Healing Embrace. And I really appreciate Mara for making that resource available to people, or telling us about it. Kevin P has some logistical questions. In particular, he seems fascinated by the state of the battlefield. He says the Lannisters are in Team Green, but since they're located at the west in Westeros, how long would the Lannister fleet take to sail south from Casterly Rock around Dorne and back up the Narrow Sea to defend King's Landing from the Valyrian fleet's blockade in the Gullet?
Lannister fleet. I mean, you can't defend it. You're going to have to break through the blockade just to get to King's Landing.
Yeah. And he says, wouldn't they repelled by Corlys's new garrisons at the Stepstones? Hell, wouldn't they go up against greater defenses at Driftmark and Dragonstone? Yes. Like,
yeah, they're screwed.
If you hold up your left hand and you make like a C shape, like a claw, like a crab claw shape. Mm-hmm. You remember all those fortresses I was talking about, like Duskendale and Claw Point and all that stuff? These are rimming around that claw on the north and south shore. And if you look at your index finger and your thumb and imagine there's two islands set right in the middle there, that's Driftmark and that's Dragonstone, which is currently has the largest fleet. You know, the house of the largest fleet in Westeros is on based out of Driftmark. The seat of black power is on Dragonstone, right smack in the middle of there. And you're suggesting that they're going to go all the way from the western shores of Westeros, sail around the, you know, summer seas, work their way again across the Stepstones, which are fully garrisoned and manned by black forces, and then force their way into that crab claw with the largest fleet blockading with numerous dragons patrolling a stretch of water that's like 20-40 miles across. I would want to do it. I'm not saying that you can't, because there's all kinds of stories where greater naval powers have been overcome by lesser naval powers. You can never forget the treachery of the sea. Think about how that has influenced, you know, like how Britain got to be a world power. It was when the Spanish got smashed at sea. The typhoon, I forget what happened in Japanese and Chinese history, where I think China was trying to invade Japan or Japan was trying to invade China, and a typhoon came and fucked everything. You just never know. But I'm saying if I was Tywin Lannister, I would not be anticipating trying to crack this particular nut. No, not at all.
I do wonder how many forces are garrisoned down at the Stepstones, how fortified that is, if the Lannister fleet could take that, if a lot of the Valyrian fleet was tied up in Blackwater or near Blackwater Bay.
Well,
that might be interesting.
Also, the Essos, you know, there's always allies, you know, clearly there's that Triarchy that was, you know, probably smarting over their loss to Corlys and the Stepstones. Like, they might make allies. And what does that look like if a green Essos alliance? Yeah. I'm not saying, like Ian said, this isn't obviously a done deal, but like, it's just showing you the stakes of like, how do you break this blockade? How do you free King's Landing? Yeah. And, you know, as far as he also asks, like, you know, how does King Supply be, you know, King's Landing look being supplied from the land?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, if you got 14 dragons dive bombing your shit, that's tough. And also just this is the infrastructure there. If 80% of what King's Landing needs goes through the ocean, you cannot just reroute that over land. You know, there's not like rail systems and logistics mm-hmm. companies are just ready to do that shit. You know, there's like, is a, yeah. So I think King's Landing is going to be in some rough times ahead, but we'll see. Jacob emails this and wondered, why didn't Vizzy T just call another Grand Council to choose between his daughter and his brother? A few more Grand Councils, maybe we'd be down the road to proto-democracy. Heyo! That was one of my big theories. I was really hoping Danny would break the wheel by doing some kind of like Magna Carta style representational democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it's not going to be like something you'd recognize out of textbooks, but it's a step in that direction. And this is, yeah, like the Grand Council is essentially a little bit of a democratic resolution to a matter of succession. And like, why not just keep doing that, man?
I mean, what were the, I guess the options were just Aegon and, but they weren't at the time. Like, that's the thing. Like, at the time, it was Daemon.
Well, I think he's right? joking of, like, when the king dies, oh, okay. instead of it, just do a grand council. Just do a grand council. All right, here's the thing. Here's the people. We could have kings or queens. What say you, lords and ladies? Well, more realistically, lords. And then, you know, a couple hundred years of that, you can then start asking the ladies. And a couple years, 100 years after that, you can start asking the small folk. And then where will we be?
Most of the way it's democracy.
Craig says, a question for Aaron. I heard from one of the showrunners that the book's point of view leans slightly towards green, and it's clear that show leans towards the blacks. Do you think this is a conscious choice by the show to overbalance this point of view or something that's happened naturally? I don't know, because like, when I'm reading Fire and Blood, I definitely feel like these, and maybe it's because these characters are so thin and so just broadly painted, but I thought a pox on both of their houses, and I was just I had some people that I liked and I thought were cool, and I was like more attracted to the personalities than to the cause. And I think what... I'm surprised to hear the one of the showrunners mention that, because like to me, what they've done is they've fleshed out and they tried to humanize everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, if the overwhelming like if the show is kind of like leaning towards Team Black, then I guess so be it. But like I never felt like the books were pro green and that but the show is definitely pro black.
So
if
far.
I'm being objective yep. about it so far. Yeah. And that's the thing is like, I do wonder if they'll ever recover from that, because there's some people that just like, well, you know, they weren't justified or they were justified. And no matter what comes after, it's always about what came before. I mean, this is how
a lot of this is
how generational struggles happen in real life, you know?
Yeah. No, they're going to have a hard time overcoming. Well, if Otto just had been less of a shit. Yeah. If they, I guess that's another fear of mine for next season is that they try and reverse course too much and try and make me sympathize so much with the greens that it just falls apart for me, because I really don't see a path to that, because I view it as an original sin problem. Like Otto is the original sin, his lust for power. That's it. The story's over.
Well, but there's also room that like we hated the Lannisters in Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
We really hated Jaime Lannister in season one.
Absolutely, yeah. Pushing kids out the window. He's fucking his sister.
Trying to kill Ned Stark for telling the truth, you know, killing his whole household staff. Like, there's a lot of... But we really like Tyrion. We always like Tyrion. And we came to really love Jaime until he lost his fucking mind at the end. So, like, there's room to hate the greens, but say this particular green is all right. This guy's trying to... Yeah. Thread the needle between his honor and what he's being asked to do and what's good of the realm. Like, there'll always be, and I think that's where we can get back to Game of Thrones, where there won't be wholly ambiguously good sides and wholly ambiguous bad sides. I don't think we even had that, because like, you know, Daemon's a maniac. Cool and I like him, but like, yeah, he's a fuck. He does some despicable shit. He's done a lot of despicable shit this year.
And Rhaenyra is kind of oblivious to the threat that her rise to power presents to the realm. I think that was true for a long time. And on the other side, they've done a great job making me sympathize with Alicent.
Yes.
For the most part, like, she's trying to thread that needle between friendship and fear. And I think they're doing a great job telling that.
But I think from all the interviews I read, Condal and Martin both know where you're at and how that people's emotions are feeling, and that they are all also saying that, like, where however you feel now, are you going to feel that way after the end of season two, after the end of season three, at the end of season four? Mm-hmm. Like, where will you be at? And I think that it's very possible that, you know, you might start off like, yeah, Team Black is awesome, but like, what if they go too far in a revenge path? Like, what point will you be sickened by their need for revenge? And at what point will you be sympathetic? And then will the Greens take that too far? It's like, I think that they're, it's one of the things I'm curious about, like how people are going to hang with this. Michael B has an opinion. While I agree sending her sons to negotiate to my Rhaenyra here is a risky move, I thought she was hesitant, and they asked, so she reluctantly did it. But wouldn't she have been under the assumption that they had a day to respond to Otto's terms, and they should have at least a day of safety since the war hadn't started yet?
Probably. Yeah, it's a fair point.
Yeah, I think this is a really good point. Like, she thinks that she's being shielded by this 24 hours of opinion, and like, yeah, maybe Otto and Alicent are out there trying to rally their banners, but the idea that her younger son would be attacked and viciously savaged by Aemon on his large dragon clearly is not even something Aemon fully thought through. So, like, yeah, I thought that I always thought it was a calculated risk, because do you think Vhagar is really out there when she should be? I mean, that's, if you want to analyze the other side, that's a foolhardy risk to send Vhagar away in those first 24 hours before you've gotten some kind of like deal. It's
so stupid, it just might work, right? That's the idea.
Yeah. But I think that's a good, that she thinks that she's got, you know, essentially that these are just being sent under the banner of being a messenger, being an envoy, and they're going to have absolute protection, which they pretty much were. Aemon just fucked up. Mike says, we saw mid-season that Vhagar breathed some fire at Caraxes, and both Caraxes and Daemon flew through it just fine. With the upcoming dragon battles, is this relevant or something we should remember when they start breathing fire at one another, or is it nothing worth remembering?
I really don't know. They've confused me on this point.
Well, I'll suggest there's a difference between a dragon breathing a big ball of fire that hangs in the air for a few seconds and then someone flies through it versus the full blast dragon fire.
Sure.
You know, that we've seen instantly turn a man to cinder.
Mm-hmm.
So like, how far, like, and I'm a dragon fire truther, and that, like, I don't believe it. I'm not a conspiracy. Like, I think that Targaryens can and do die from fire all the fucking time.
Okay.
And this is playing with the idea of Targaryens thinking they're fireproof.
Mm-hmm.
And having experiences where it's like, you know, hey, one time when I was 13, I burned a brush fire with some gasoline and fuel oil, and I felt a little bit like Daemon Targaryen, like, holy fuck, I must be fireproof, because I just got engulfed in fire for a second there, and I'm okay. My eyebrows are singed, but let me tell you, I am not fireproof. I've since learned. So, like, yeah. I think that, like, sometimes the Targaryens go looking, like, you know, if Viserys is like, look how long I can hold my handle on this candle before it hurts too bad. I must be a fucking true blood
Targaryen,
of the dragon. Right? Like, they do shit like that because that's their legend, and they're self-consciously trying to live up to that.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. We'll see.
So, yeah. And also, like, the dragon, it's entirely possible that a dragon's fire is not its best weapon against a dragon. You saw Vhagar. She didn't breathe fire at this. She just fucking chomped. Mm-hmm. They have giant-ass claws. They have giant-ass teeth. They have huge-ass jaws. They can just rip and tear. So that's a problem. And I don't think Targaryens are resistant to rip and tearing. So,
yeah, they have a lot of opportunity to clarify this issue coming up. And I expect them to.
Ernest says, when Vhagar killed Luke and Arrax in the last episode, I couldn't shake the thought of the possibility she might be killing one of her own kids or grandkids in Arrax. I'm not sure the lineage of the dragons, but is it possible that Arrax is a descendant of Vhagar? Aren't all the dragons in the book or show descendants of the three dragons that came over to Westeros with Aegon and his sisters? Could it be that this show is not only a civil war in which one human family is fighting, but also a civil war amongst a family of dragons? I know kinslaying is not uncommon in the animal kingdom, but aren't dragons in fantasy supposed to be smarter than regular animals? I know I might be stretching it a bit with the show theory, but I think it's cool that we're seeing a dragon civil war here as well, even if the writers are not intending us to see it this way. You got any insight in that as a non-book reader, Jim, before
I feel like that would be possible.
My two cents.
I just have a hard time imagining how they'll convey to me that these dragons are part of a family and convey that family tree to where I know, shit, the uncle just bit the nephew in half.
Right.
I don't know how they
do
that.
Because, like, you know, you're going to have these scenes. Like, I always think of it in terms of, like, subtitled dragon scenes where it's like, you are a dragon, a second-born dragon of no great lineage. I am the son. I am the grandsire of Beleriand the dragon. Like, and they're just all talking these monster voices. But directly answer your question, I think, yeah. And also, the Targaryens had more than just the three dragons. They had a few more. But yeah, whatever subset of dragons they came over with from old Valyria is the stock that all dragons come from. And one thing I've always been in the back of my mind is, like, you know, people like, did the Targaryens forget how to raise dragons? Did the Maesters get all butthurt because their science was being threatened by these magical beings and they poisoned and gave the Targaryens bad advice, like keep him in the dragon pit? I've always thought it's like, well, maybe they just got fucking inbred. Mm-hmm. Like, we saw what happened to Targaryens after you run, you know, you no longer have all of old Valyria to intermarry. You've got, like, one single branch of a family tree. Things got mentally imbalanced. Things got physically imbalanced. People started getting born with gross deformities and whatnot. And, like, are we not sure that the stunting of the dragon was just them being too inbred for their own good?
Yeah, could be.
Because there's not a lot of fresh blood flowing on that side either, you know. They seem like, you know, so we've got 14 on one side, 4 on the other, with some dread. Like, you can't get a stable population from 20 adult individuals, can you?
No, I wouldn't think so. I don't know how it works in the reptile world, the dragon world, but probably not.
Maybe that's all right, but, like, yeah, you'd have to probably be, and but also directly answer your question, the books don't go into detail about the dragon's lineage. You mentioned that there are clutches from certain dragons, but you have no idea who the father is. You have no idea if they're reproducing sexually or asexually. There's just a lot we still don't know about this stuff. So, hell, I didn't even know that dragons were born in these steamy little sacks until I saw it on screen. I didn't know what a dragon clutch looked like. So, lots of stuff to discover. Rachel, regarding feedback about Alicent and Rhaenyra being portrayed as less evil than Otto and Daemon, she says, I think this analysis is unfair because they're all in different points in life. When we meet Otto and Daemon as grown men, Daemon is immature, but he's effectively grown. We meet Alicent and Rhaenyra as girls, led to believe their lives are part of a bigger picture, things they are told by the men that they loved and trusted. It's natural to want to compare them to Cersei, but that's also unfair because we met her also as an adult already making moves. Season one ends up both walking on a slippery slope, so to speak. Otto and the gang were perfectly happy to leave Alicent at the starting line, despite her husband and baby daddies dying hours ago, and her acknowledgement of Rhaenyra as the heir at the family dinner. No one hesitated to disregard and undermine her. Rhaenyra's father has died. She's ascending, losing her baby, and crying for help all at once. The heir to the throne is miscarrying another potential heir, and it's too intense for the menfolk. Fuck their feelings and their discomfort. Get with her and make an interim succession plan, not a surprise C-section, for her precarious health. Once immediate defense plans are in place, Daemon and the boys should have urgently stood vigil for her, as a court would have done for a king. Her eldest sons have her back, but aren't council or battle ready. Now we leave them as grown women, realizing the bigger picture was always someone else's chessboard. I predict Alicent had 6 months before Otto married her off to a respectable house, like Tywin planned for Cersei. And Rhaenyra would have been Viserys 2.0, consulted for feasts, tourneys, and managing Daemon. But now they're adults like Cersei when we meet her. Cersei, who came of age among Tywin, Baelish, and Varys. She learned the great game from them and turned into a fucking monster. Their evil has not yet begun, and I'm already looking forward to them fucking shit up in season two. I mean, I agree with all this, but the thing is, what I got from this story is, like, you mentioned that, like, we already meet Cersei as a fully formed adult. But what we know of Cersei from the books is that, you know, she's just a product of her maniacal fucking up from Tywin and his emphasis on dynasty and losing his wife over the birth of Tyrion. Like, this family is dysfunctional as fuck. And if we had, you know, grew up with Cersei the way we grew up with Alicent and Rhaenyra, we might feel different about her as a character, you know?
Mm-hmm. Potentially.
So, like, yeah, this is all true. And that's one of the things I think the showrunners, like, people are like, oh, made fun of the idea that Matt Smith and Rhys Ifans never really aged in the roles. But everything I've read, so that was an intention by the showrunner to really emphasize the youth of these women, that they're going to physically change because they're not yet adults, where the men who have been kind of running their lives are kind of unchangeable because they were, you know, they were fully grown. So they're accentuating mm-hmm. the youth and inexperience of the women and how they're kind of like manipulated by the men. So I think you're right. But like, I also think that like everyone's got a story of how their upbringing kind of fucked them up in Game of Thrones. So if we knew more about the youth of these people, and that's something that it could be exciting. Like, they ever explore Robert's Rebellion, like going back and seeing, you know, Robert and Ned as young men and, you know, Cersei as a young girl who's kind of like all Twitter-pated about the idea of marrying Robert Baratheon. And I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, I think the thing it did in this series is turn this into more of a tragedy for these women.
Yes.
Because I did not feel that about Cersei. I feel that about Allison and Rhaenyra. And I'm really appreciating that difference, because you could sort of see Allison in a similar light to a Cersei at this point, if you didn't have all that context from her childhood and how she was changed by the people around her and the events of her life.
Raymond says, one thing I'd love to hear your opinion on is Helena's dreaming, or rather your take on other characters' perception of her dreaming. I love how several of her prophecies have come true already, but one thing remains oddly unclear to me. Are the other characters in the House of the Dragon even aware of her prophetic accuracy? Is Helena herself? You're about to fight a civil war, and one of the central players on your side has proven to have precognitive abilities. It sure seems like that's something you'd want to pay attention to. But so far, it seems as though Alicent is the only person who's even heard her prophecies, and she seemingly brushed them off. I halfway wonder if Helena herself is scarcely aware of her dreaming. Perhaps it's a little like idle humming. She just sort of babbles out loud every now and then, and her premonitions are as mysterious and inscrutable to her as they are to everyone else. What do you make of this? Is dreaming typically taken seriously by those in a Targaryen family? What does the realm in general think of it? We know a few famous Targaryens who took dreaming seriously. Viserys, now Aegon the Conqueror, the father of Daenys the Dreamer, who first moved to the family of Dragonstone. But are they quirky exceptions rather than to the rule? So Helena being a dreamer and prophesying is a show-only creation, so you're just as capable of commenting as this as me. What do you think about Greens? Did Greens know that they're sitting on a gold mine here?
I don't think so.
They got a magic eight ball.
No, I think they look at her and they see someone who's mentally damaged and write her off entirely.
Yeah.
And even to a degree, her mom does that. And I think Helena herself, I think she's aware that the things she's seeing, the voices she's hearing, whatever, however these prophecies come to her, that these events are coming true. I just think she's unable or unwilling to communicate that to anyone. Because you can see her like at the ceremony, right? She repeats the beast beneath the boards, as if she knows this is the moment that's going to happen. And then she watches it happen. And I think she knows that is a fulfillment of the thing she saw, the vision.
Yeah.
But she makes no effort to communicate that to anyone. So she, and I can't tell. She seems to be somewhere on the like autism spectrum, mm-hmm. Based on the way they're portraying
certainly
her.
Not a neurotypical, you'd say.
Right, right. And so,
and it's seen as such by her brothers, like Aegon's, like, yeah, uh-huh. She's just always babbling crazy shit, you know?
Right, right. But none of them take the time or the attention to figure out what she's trying to say and seeing if events apply, the things she's saying apply to events in real life. And I guess why would they, right? If you just want to write this person off.
Well, it's like, also a
you're
proud,
not going to invest the time.
It's a proud Martin tradition. Like in the main canon of the Song of Ice and Fire sequence, there's this fool named Patchface that's the court jester of Stannis Baratheon, and he hangs around a Shireen. He's got this jigsaw puzzle tattooed on his face, and his backstory is he survived a shipwreck and through that experience became kind of a simple-minded person. He's just always kind of like babbling and singing songs to himself, but several fans have noticed that like all of his songs, as the story progresses, seems like they're having these fulfillments. You know, they're hinting to the like the Red Wedding, and there's all sorts of other different hints about the others and whatnot. But no one knows because Patchface is a fool. He's a simple-minded fool. Why would you ever pay attention to the shit he says, much less write it down and try to figure it out? And I think they never really played with that much in the – well, at all in the main series. It'd be cool to kind of bring a Patchface-like character where it's this tragic person who sees all these fates unfolding, but no one takes her serious because the prophecy is like – yeah, you saw that brand. The more Weirwoody Bran got, the more weird and detached humanity he got. So they might suggest that like if you are intently plugged into this kind of pipeline, it changes you. Are no longer like able to relate to humans the way a baseline person could, because it just kind of fucks you up. I think that'd be cool. But yeah, I concur with you. I don't think any of the greens. I wonder if someone more perceptive like Alicent or Otto will make a note of this, the beast, you know, and like start using that as like an oracle. But I again, since none of that stuff is in the books, I'm gonna guess that no, that it's just always going to be this kind of tragic foreknowledge that doesn't really help her. It just makes everything she goes through that much worse. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to Hot D.
Yeah, I would expect if anybody was going to take note and make the connection to be a maester, but boy, they don't have any maesters around that are main character enough to make that realization and development. So
yeah, and maesters are not the type that kind of concern themselves with magic and prophecy. They kind of poo-poo it in this world, you know.
Yeah, sure. I was just thinking they are the most observant and most concerned with the goings-ons of stuff, but you might be right.
I think it's a really reductive look at science, too. Like, if there was real-life magic, guess who would be studying it? Guess who the magicians would be? Fucking scientists.
Right.
You know? Like, the idea that maesters are like, you know what? We don't like this shit that we can't figure out. It doesn't make rational sense. You know what? We're just going to refuse to study it. Like, I always thought that was such a reductive look at... But I guess it's like scientists in the medieval period, you know?
Sure, but then eventually the people who break you out of that pattern are also scientists. So
they're like, also scientists, yeah.
It's just...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, people's biases
like
change.
Isaac Newton was just shy of a warlock, and he also invented calculus. But, you know... Riley says, gentlemen, I for one believe that Ryan Condal and team did a great job of keeping Hot D in the Game of Thrones universe, but at the same time making a stand on your own. But can we indulge in some crossover funsies? I'm curious to know what your thoughts are in some of the following scenarios. These are kind of fun. Would Ned have kept his oath to Queen or King Viserys and Princess Rhaenyra?
Yes.
100%. Yeah, I mean,
he's the lealest in the land. I mean, there is no one more leal than Ned Stark.
Yeah, Starks are leal. They're infra-real leal. You need special equipment to see in that leal spectrum. The human eye can't detect it, and that's why nobody takes it seriously. Mm-hmm. Would Bobby B have sold out for a marriage alliance?
Bobby B have sold out for a marriage alliance? Sold out? What do you mean sold out?
Well, my question is this before or after Lyanna Stark runs off with Rhaegar? Because canonically, this breaks Robert Baratheon. Now, Ned privately is skeptical that his sister would ever have trucked with Bob. But in his mind, that was the woman for him. That was his one true love. And like, he never took the concept seriously. And the Cersei thing was never anything more than an instrument of power and to kind of make night. He never wanted to be king. This is all a bunch of shit. So like, post Lyanna death, I think Robert does whatever the fuck the hand tells him to do so he can go back to whoring and fucking and dying an early death.
Okay.
Would have Varys been on Team Green or Team Black? This is an interesting question.
Varys is worried about the good of the realm. I could see him going to Team Green on this.
And the only thing that would... So the one thing that Varys hates above all else is black magic.
Okay.
Because that's the one longstanding prejudice he has. Like, people that dabble in the dark arts and all that shit. Like, yeah, like, this is fucking bullshit. And none of the team... Like, it's interesting to see where, like, Missaria will go. Because if she aligns the one, like, that would put Varys off. And also Helena, like, that too. Like, if she kind of, like, turns into a more kind of witchy type of archetype, that... But, like...
Okay.
He might... But the thing is also, like, if he looks at Aegon and he looks at Jacaerys, I think he sees one king who is going to be an out-and-out disaster and one that looks like it'd be okay. And Rhaenyra is not... He might be Team Black... just for the good of the realm. But if the Team Green has got it all sewn up, he might go for that just to spare the realm.
Yeah, to avoid war. He also changed his mind on Daenerys over the course of the series, right? Wasn't he one of the ones that was saying, was like trying to influence her death, like get her killed earlier on? I can't remember.
Whose death?
Daenerys? Danny?
Yeah, he was trying to help, yeah. But there is, you know, in the deep lore of the universe, there's this secret conspiracy theory where Varys and Illyrio are conspiring to put a Targaryen on the throne.
The exact opposite of what it looked
like. They have their own scheme going that may or may not include Daenerys or might be able to switch to be Daenerys later. So, like, yeah.
But they turn.
Martin needs to finish his fucking books.
But Varys turned around on that by the end of the series, right? So I feel like
sure.
I'm not certain where he'd end up. At this stage, probably green, if I had to guess.
At this moment, since they've got like Kingsland, it looks like the Rhaenyra is going to have to do war to win to get it back, probably. But like before Viserys' death, I think he would back Rhaenyra and Jace over Aegon. But, you know.
Possibly.
Finally, would a young Daemon and young Tyrion be Fleabottom bosom buddies? I think maybe. Daemon and Tyrion would get along great.
Yeah.
And if Tyrion's a secret Targaryen, so much the better.
Mm-hmm. They're dragon riding together.
The littlest dragon rider. Yeah, I think they would get a kick out of each other for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be fun. I would love to see those scenes.
Yeah. It's essentially young. It's also a lot of young Jaime and young Tyrion. You know, it's like a lot of that same energy. Okay. Finally, we have a dragon lore roundup, and this will be the last until I talk to Kim next week. Zeke says, I've been asking about dragons all season, and it's essentially why I'm watching this show and why I've watched Game of Thrones. I know the show will give or make us make new canon up, but I want some speculation. Things we learned this season. Number one, dragon eggs come out of steam and molten rock. Yep. Two, the dragon keepers are heavily involved in training and keeping, but who are they loyal to? Are they loyal to the family or the dragons themselves? Or are they loyal to a keep and or a castle like the Maesters?
Good
what do
question.
You think, Jim?
I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know either. Daemon conscripted them, which made it seem like, but there's also a bunch of them at the dragon pit.
Mm-hmm.
So unless they show us a scene where the dragon maester, the dragon keepers essentially refuse to fight, I guess they're more like the maesters, where it's like, well, the dragons here on Dragonstone are loyal to the dragons of Dragonstone, and the dragons at the dragon pit will be loyal to. But like, you know, on this scale, this has never happened before, where the House Targaryen just splits down the middle and goes to war. So this might be some untested stuff.
What if you're a dragon trainer at King's Landing and your dragon decides to defect over to Team Black and roost over at Dragonstone? Do you try and go to Dragonstone
dragon
to be with your dragon?
Dragon rider?
No, the dragon itself just decides, hey, I don't want to be part of this.
Yeah,
Hightower
it seems
battle.
Likely that each dragon would have a couple of dragon keepers that are kind of theirs, you know, that they have. Mm-hmm. So like,
I would think so.
And I would imagine if that dragon takes off, like, no, they wouldn't be allowed to leave.
right. So they just no longer be a dragon trainer, or they help train the remaining dragons.
It's hard to say because they're also very different from the books. Like in the books, the dragon keepers are like this elite group of warriors and is all black armor, and they're significantly different than the more kind of like monk religious type monks of the series. So I that's
it's like
a that's
a
good ass question
or something, right? You if the animal that you've been keeping, like let's say you keep pandas or something, and a panda is like transferred over to a different zoo for whatever reason, you don't go with the panda. You're just like, well, I hope the next panda trainer caretaker is going to be as good as I was to it.
What about Star Trek 4? That lady followed George and Gracie into the 23rd century, man.
Fair.
That's a hell of a job transfer.
Yeah. Yeah. No accounting for fantasy, I guess.
For time traveling Klingon warships. Mm-hmm. Three, speaking or singing in High Valyrian is highly important. Is that all you need to know to be a dragon rider? Boy. This is where, let's say you had German shepherds and they're exclusively bred and trained in Germany, so they'd only respond to German commands. Then you take you take those German shepherds and you move them to America, and now the next generation of German pups you teach in English. I think that's the situation we got right now, where it's like the Targaryens, for their own purposes, have trained these dragons. They understand High Valyrian and the only respond to High Valyrian. But it's not clear to me that that's because dragons instinctually know High Valyrian, or there's some kind of magical tie to old Valyria there, or if it's just the way they've been trained.
Gotcha.
I wonder if the show will explore that.
And how, if so, if they only respond to High Valyrian, how good does your accent have to be?
Yeah.
If it's supposed to be Dracarys and you say Dracarys, do they like, come on, man,
Come well, on. That's the case. Pronounce it right, maybe. I know one thing. Masaria will never be a dragon rider because she is incapable of speaking.
The French and high Valyrian languages do not
Make the sense. Common tongue. Like, I'd like to see her takes on old Valyria. It's like, what is this? It's like the dragons are like, does she have peanut butter in her mouth? What the fuck is happening? I'm doubtful, but we'll see. For apparently, and he says, please debate, any dragon rider can claim any dragon. What about Sea Smoke? What's your take on this?
Boy, Sea Smoke, refresh my memory. What's
Sea Smoke is Laenor's, he's up for grabs. He's Laenor's old dragon.
Okay.
He's a battle tested dragon.
Gotcha. My take is yes, that is true. You can just walk up to a dragon and claim it as long as the dragon is willing to be claimed by you. That's what the Vhagar experience told me.
Again, there's a lot of up for grabs. Like, was Vhagar kind of charmed by the temerity of this kid going up and trying to claim her? Is she kind of like the way a big dog can kind of instinctively know to be gentle around babies? It's kind of like a situation like that where she's showing her this kid a lot more forbearance than she would like a big strapping guy who's, you know, going to come in their commander, this, that, and the other. Like, I don't know.
I mean, I guess the bigger question I would have is, can you claim someone else's dragon if they're still alive? That would apply to Sea Smoke, A, but B, could I walk up to Caraxes and go, hey, Caraxes, I think I would be a lot better dragon rider for you than Daemon is.
Right. That's the thing.
How about you join my... How about you just abandon? Like, can you seduce a dragon?
Yeah. That is an interesting angle about Sea Smoke, because we know that their rider is still alive. And that is going to be a very interesting... Because, again, the stuff is all very nebulous in the books. Laenor is much more unambiguously dead in the books. I'm very curious to see how they kind of square the circle myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I understood that, like, there is some ineffable quality that might be inheritable and genetic that makes you a dragon rider, capable of riding a dragon, but not every dragon would submit to your will. That there is still, like, sure, you have to be to claim certain dragons that are certain to be, they're strong willed or like older and crankier. You need a more self-possessed and confident dragon rider. But then again, you've also got the stories of like 4-year-old princesses smacking Balerion on the snout and telling him that he's a bad dragon and Balerion kind of being cowed by that. So like, you never fucking know. You never fucking know. Like one of Jaehaerys's kids did that, I believe.
Nice.
Like essentially rolled up a newspaper and smacked Balerion on his snout because he got too cheeky with her. But 5, the dragons can sense the intention of their rider. We saw Daemon and Rhaenys both were able to control, quote unquote, their dragons wordlessly. Caraxes defending Daemon to multiple envoys, Melees escaping the dragon pit, Laena with Vhagar. There are words, you know, Dracarys, but still. I think this, broadly speaking, yes, the dragon has some kind of simpatico. You know, I don't know what they're showing Syrax screaming in the dragon pit across the fucking city from Rhaenyra, unless they're trying to explicitly say, yes, there is some kind of psychic link and they share each other's kind of grief and pain. Which also follows 6. The dragons can apparently feel the pain of their rider. Yeah, we definitely saw multiple examples of that. And then finally, the Targaryens. Could Targaryens have possibly some actual dragon blood in their bloodline? We've seen children deformed and described as dragon-like. Is there any truth to the popular conception that the Valyrians have literal dragon blood in their veins?
I mean, maybe. Look, it's a fantasy world. A lot of things are possible, and I think they are definitely hinting at that possibility with the birth, Rhaenyra's latest birth. But they would have to make it a lot more explicit for me to go, okay, there's definitely, like, somebody has fucked a dragon in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, and you got like, so pure blood can go too far. Like, you push through to the other side and like, oh, you got too much dragon blood. Now you got scaly wings and stubby tails and you're going to die at birth because you're too you're too much of a chimera.
Sure.
I don't
know. Yeah, and then they look, if this is a three-step Martin reveal, that birth was like the first step. And then maybe the second one will convince me. And if not, they'll need a third step if that's what they're trying to do.
Can I say something as a final thought?
Yeah.
I hope they leave some dragon lore mysterious.
Oh.
Because you had a whole continent of that of long-standing traditions and magic practice and stuff to tame and breed and make these dragons an instrument of war. I find it highly unlikely that the Targaryens, a minor dragon lord house of little renown that fled the country and was so insignificant that none of the other Valyrians paused their political squabbling to go track down this house that's fled and gone to this other backwater and exterminated them. I find it highly unlikely that they are the end-all be-all of dragon knowledge. And I think some things are just going to be lost. And that some things maybe even the dragon riders of Valyria didn't understand. Because again, they took this so fucking far, they blew up their whole continent, is what the official story is. They pushed this blood magic and this dragon magic to where all their volcanoes simultaneously erupted into some kind of pyroclastic orgy of violence. So like, did they fucking know what they're doing? I would say no. I want a lot of dragon lore to just be mysterious. And I know it's going to annoy a lot of you fucking nerds, but I like it when some lore is mysterious and up for interpretation and is not mechanistic.
And if they are going to give us a lot more of the details of how to train your dragon, I would love something along the lines of the Syrio-Arya training scenes. Like, and that's less likely now that Luke is out of the picture because...
Yeah.
Something that's like fun that is more lighthearted, that explains to me like, okay, how do you train your dragon, right? Like, how do you ride a dragon? How do you care for a dragon? Like, what are the details behind them? Just in a more fun way, because I did not feel like the Luke, I assume it was Araxes or Arax rather, scenes from earlier in the season were that thing that I was looking for.
Gotcha.
Because I really enjoy that Arya Syrio stuff.
I think there's definitely going to be new dragon riders are going to have to be trained. You know, they kind of set that concept up in this season with Daemon kind of going over to dragons and, you know, that they got not only unclaimed dragons, but dragons that have never been claimed. You know, we talk about the Grey Ghost and Sheep Stealer and the Cannibal and... Like,
there's just a few that the writers that don't have dragons yet. Lena's like the only one I can really think of.
Right. Joffrey. Well, that's what we got. Are you talking about Rhaena? That's the daughter of Lena that hasn't got a dragon.
Yes,
as far as we know.
Sorry, okay. Rhaena. Yes, the younger of the two.
It'll happen.
Valyrian grandchildren, sisters. Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, like I said, as much as I'd like to give you answers to everything, we don't have the answers to everything. And I secretly hope we'd never get the answers.
Damn.
If dragons just become like, you know, divide D by T equals, you know, this. It's like, I don't know. I don't know. This seems in the antithesis of what we're supposed to understand about dragons, which they are mysterious and mercurial and hard to control, even under the best circumstances. So... thank you for another great season. There will be one more wrap-up podcast. I'm going to have a conversation with my colleague, Kim Renfro. She writes for The Insider. She co-hosted with David Chin over on The Cast of Kings. She's fantastic. We're going to be talking about the impacts of the prophecy, what it's like co-hosting with a person that doesn't read the books, her take on some of the other theories. There might be a little bit more consciously spoilery thing at the end of that podcast because there's some things... I kind of want to talk to her book reader to book reader, but we'll definitely clearly mark and talk about that so you can shut off the podcast before we get there. That will be coming out sometime next week. Thank you for listening. It's been a great season. If this is the last time you listen to us, again, follow us on twitter.com/baldmove to keep up with what we're doing. There's a lot of cool things. There's a lot of stuff that's coming out in 2023 that I'm very excited for. We talked about that on previous podcast, but you want to follow us on Twitter if you want to keep up with what we're doing at Bald Move. A lot of people have joined us in the club. If you want in on our Christmas celebrations, in particular, if you're in the United States and you want a physical Christmas card from me and Jim, you got to be part of the club before Thanksgiving. And also if you're not in America, not in the United States, I almost said the Americas, but like, no, we're also, we can't afford to ship to South and Central America at this scale. If you're not in America, you will, and you're in a club member, you will receive a digital card, a high res digital copy that you can print out and hang up, however you wanted to display it. But yeah, you got to be in the club by Thanksgiving. Support.baldmove.com if you want to get in on that. Otherwise, yeah, we'll look forward to seeing you guys back for season two and or back for our conversation with Kim next week and with Maester Anthony going into Clash of Kings. Again, it's been a great season. Glad to have you all with us. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.